This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
I appreciate you tuning in today. I'm Joel Hilliker. The world provides a stunning study in contrasts right now. America was until recently the world's top superpower, but it is now divided, weak, aimless, consumed by its own problems, completely uninterested in engaging the rest of the world. Meanwhile, Russia is gaining control over major parts of Eastern Europe. It's laying down demands aimed at destroying NATO. China is marching through the South China Sea. It's threatening its neighbors, and it's using economic weapons and growing military might to effectively take over whole countries. In our first segment, we'll talk about the reality of the world order right now. What was life like in the Soviet Union, one of the most murderous regimes in history? A Russian organization called Memorial International, founded after the fall of the Soviet Union, has worked to document historical crimes and mass human rights violations committed in the Soviet Union. Well, 3 weeks ago, Russia's Supreme Court shut it down and tried to silence it. Trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic interviewed an official from this organization. She has a lot to say about how Russia is still languishing under the repressive legacy of its past and how Vladimir Putin is crushing dissent. In our third segment, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the domestic marijuana trade in California and how Mexican drug cartels are taking over. If you believe that legalizing marijuana puts the cartels out of business, you need to listen to this story. And for the last word on today's show, we'll continue our discussion on how to deepen your friendships. Let's start, though, by talking about the world order as it stands right now. Do you believe that America is the greatest country in the world? You might need to open your eyes because other nations are making a strong case to the contrary. And let me turn your attention to a couple of them. China just signed an agreement with virtually the whole of Latin America and the Caribbean. 33 countries, we wrote about this on thetrumpet.com, 33 countries, including major economies such as Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Cuba, Mexico, Nicaragua, Panama, and Venezuela, agreed to a comprehensive plan that will cover almost all aspects of life for over 680 million people. It includes resolutions to incorporate Chinese language education, establish a space cooperation forum, and explore geological and mining resources in the CELAC member countries. So this is the capstone on work that China has been doing for decades in Latin America. China has replaced America as South America's top trading partner. It's really doing nothing less than trying to take over America's own backyard. This is just one dramatic instance of the way that China is rapidly expanding its power and influence across the globe. It is a manufacturing giant, and it floods the world with cheap goods. This creates huge trade surpluses that supply China with mountains of cash. And how is it spending that money? Well, it's expanding its power. It's aggressively chasing down resources all over the world. It provides development assistance, infrastructure construction, and investment to foreign nations. And then, when these nations can't repay loans, it uses its leverage to extract even deeper concessions. So it is rapidly growing a global empire. And it's worth noting that China is totally unconcerned with dictatorships, with human rights, or other issues that keep America out of these foreign markets. China is happy to do business with Russia, with North Korea, Pakistan, Zimbabwe, Sudan, Venezuela, Cuba, and just about anywhere else. It just signed a comprehensive strategic partnership with Iran that will flood this terrorist sponsoring state with cash. In fact, a leaked copy of the deal calls for combining military training, exercises, weapons development, and intelligence sharing. It could really reshape the balance of power in the Middle East. Now, meanwhile, America is unwilling to use its military force. It relies on economic tools to punish nations that it considers rogue. Being shut out of America's markets, those nations are even quicker to rush into the arms of China. As China is expanding, America is retreating. It's pulling out of Europe. It's pulling out of the Middle East. Most embarrassingly, last summer, America evacuated from Afghanistan in the most humiliating fashion conceivable, turning it back over to the very terrorist organization we went there to defeat, abandoning allies who risked their lives to help us, and leaving at least hundreds of our own people behind. And yet, stunningly, for most Americans, this is already ancient history. Didn't even happen 5 months ago, and it almost feels like it's as distant in the past as the Vietnam War. China is snuffing out freedom in Hong Kong. It's shutting down all voices of dissent, and nobody will do anything about this. China is pressuring nations to sever ties with Taiwan, which it considers a breakaway province, and nations are complying out of fear of offending China. Many analysts say it's just a matter of time before China invades Taiwan, and one wonders who would stop it if it chose to do so. America certainly has no stomach to start a war over some remote island in East Asia. Americans can self-righteously denounce the lack of freedom in China, the fact that dissent is not permitted, that the internet is heavily regulated, that the government gives citizens a score to measure their loyalty, that if you say the wrong thing, you can simply disappear. But now in America, our own freedom of speech is being rapidly and dramatically curtailed by the gatekeepers of big tech who are in bed with leftist politicians. If you dissent from whatever they deem is orthodox, you're blotted out, you're banned, censored, you're disappeared. If the left finds something you said years ago that isn't correct, you can lose your job in a heartbeat. The gap between authoritarian China and the land of the free isn't nearly as wide as it used to be. In America, the constitutionally protected freedom of speech is not used to protect differences in political thought. It's used to defend smut and filth. It protects the rights of children to access pornography on smartphones. The Bill of Rights doesn't protect the right of churchgoers to assemble or to teach what they believe is truth. But it does protect young people's right to identify as transgender and to use the public bathroom of their choice, and the right of schools to hide this behavior from their parents. America is teaching its next generation that math is racist, that grammar is unnecessary, that advanced placement classes are unfair. California is confronting poor academic performance by simply eliminating D's and F's from the grading scale. Our schools are teaching history that fixates on our nation's supposed sins rather than the nobility of its founding principles. And instead of reading and writing, schools are encouraging elementary school children to explore gender fluidity. We teach our children that the country they've been born into is irredeemably racist, but that they are repositories of wisdom, that they're superior to their parents and everyone around them, and that they're destined to lead the world into an anti-racist, gender-inclusive, environmentally friendly utopia. America is in a leadership crisis. Nearly half the leaders have bought wholesale into a destructive ideology that weakens the country in every way. Radical policies, economic immoderation and madness, hostility toward all tradition, unrestrained amorality. These leaders cast aside laws and rights to punish their political enemies. They're proving themselves willing to lie, cheat, steal, even kill to serve the quote-unquote greater good of attaining and clinging to power. That's half of the leaders in the country, and the other half of the leaders are simply too irresolute and weak, too compromised to stop them. America's political system promotes leaders who are skilled at appealing to self-interested, ignorant voters. Politicians who must continually run for re-election rather than govern. A great many of America's voters have been taught that America is the greatest force of evil in the world and that all foreign intervention is colonialist, racist, and evil. They don't know enough to imagine what a Middle East ruled by Iran or what a world ruled by China and Russia would look like. They're just convinced that the less America, the better. But if people are really concerned about the evils of imperialism, they should be denouncing China and Russia. Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin say that the relationship between their two nations is now better than a formal alliance. Putin is solidly behind Xi's efforts to control Hong Kong, to conquer Taiwan, to crush China's Uyghur population, to take over the South China Sea. And Xi robustly supports Putin's moves to build an energy weapon against Eastern Europe, to reignite war in the Balkans, to block Ukraine from joining the EU, and to destroy NATO. These two leaders are actively extending their borders, and they're turning foreign peoples into vassal states. Russia just moved its troops into Kazakhstan to put down unrest in that country, and it is unlikely to move out. Poland is warning that Europe is closer to war than it has been for 30 years. Russia just began a cyber attack against Ukraine a few days ago, and a lot of people are warning that this could be a precursor to invasion. In an article by Fred Reed, this author wrote, "The Chinese government is heavily technocratic, rife with engineers, scientists, and economists. At the top, Xi Jinping is a chemical engineer. Biden is a second-rate lawyer graduating low in his class at a mediocre law school after being caught cheating. America chooses leaders, if they quite are, in popularity contests, and so has leaders whose chief accomplishment is being popular. When last I looked, I think that in all of Congress, there was one scientist. Since America's leaders are elected every 2, 4, or 6 years, they spend more time running for re-election than governing, posing, polishing their images, consulting pollsters, testing the wind. Today, the midterms preoccupy Washington with polls looking not at what the country needs, but how not to look soft on China or Russia." Xi Jinping is called the president of China, which makes it sound like he wins elections and governs a republic. In fact, he is a dictator, commanding nearly 1 out of every 5 people on the planet. He has a lot of other titles, like General Secretary of the Communist Party, Chairman of the Central Military Commission, Core Leader, and Paramount Leader. Xi Jinping doesn't have to deal with elections. He doesn't have to negotiate his budget with congressmen who oppose him. He's accountable to nobody, and he can do what he likes. When he decides to do something, it is done. Whether it's building hundreds of brand new cities from scratch on newly developed land, or constructing some 24,000 miles of high-speed rail and other modern infrastructure in China, or developing his nation's space program to steal and surpass American technology or colonize the moon, or expanding and advancing China's nuclear weapons arsenal. And because he's changing the Constitution so he can rule forever, he can think long term. Meanwhile, America can't do any of these things. As Fred Reed wrote, it bogs down in a tangle of bureaucracy, infighting by special interests, and struggles over funding. America cannot undertake high-speed rail because the Republicans would block funding. Airlines would pay Congress to drop the idea. Racial lobbies would object that it went through their neighborhoods. Environmentalists and many others would file suit, and the project would degenerate into pork. The Chinese seem quicker, more agile, faster to market, to be moving into the future while America remains almost torpid. 5G, rapidly built out, quickly gets put to use in ports and factories. The digital yuan booms along while America talks. The digitization of almost everything roars ahead. While American trains creep along, China's 360-mile-per-hour model is in advanced development, Companies seem to get an idea Tuesday morning and have it in production by Friday afternoon. China ignores and flaunts climate change protocols and environmental regulations with impunity, and nobody complains. America works harder than any nation on earth to restrict pollutants, and politicians still insist on shackling our economy all the more. Fred Reed wrote, "American government is weak. Rebellious groups riot night after night, burning and vandalizing, and government does nothing. Flash mobs loot stores, and organized shoplifting drives stores out of cities, and governments look on when they do not actually approve. Crime flourishes, carjackings, racial attacks, shootings, and governments do nothing." Since the Chinese do not loot, I can't be sure how they would solve the problem. They don't have the problem because they are civilized and we no longer are. America could end looting with four words: looters will be shot, followed by perhaps two demonstrations. But American governments have ceded control of the streets to pillagers. The standard of living in China has been rapidly rising over four decades. In America, our infrastructure is decaying. Our cities are increasingly filled with homeless people. Drug abuse has become endemic. Incomes are falling. Personal debt is rising. And illegal immigration is bringing some 2 million people in each year who do not respect America's laws and have no interest in adopting American culture. This is all dramatic evidence of a complete sea change in the world order, if people would only open their eyes to recognize it. America is no longer the world's greatest superpower. It is, in fact, already far along a steep civilizational decline and has been overtaken by foreign powers on a very different trajectory. The era of the United States is over. Now, you may realize that America just isn't what it used to be, but you probably don't grasp half the magnitude of this historical turning point. America's critics and enemies recognize what's going on. They're thrilled to watch America fade, and they're working hard to erase its influence completely. Remarkably, even most Americans are relieved that the U.S. is relinquishing its powerful role. But the big question now is, what happens next? Historically speaking, the fall of an empire is a dangerous time. As historian Andrew Roberts warned, the most costly wars in modern history have arisen whenever there is confusion about which is the world's preeminent power. As far as global stability is concerned, America is shrinking to a tiny power at a terrible time. The Middle East is a terrible muddle. Iran's power is growing. Weapons of mass destruction are proliferating and will end up in the hands of more and more tyrants and terrorists. Islamism will spread in northern Africa. Volatility in Europe will arise even as Germany's power grows. Contention over resources will fuel increasing tension among European and Asian nations. Arms races in multiple regions will continue to mushroom. You can be sure the number of crises will increase. The calls for action and for intervention are bound to escalate. And because America is no longer the one to step up, the position of dominance is up for grabs, both within regions and globally. We're leaving behind a comfortable era of Western dominance and entering a new and uncertain era of violent competition for supremacy among remorseless foes. The remarkable thing is, this cruel era was specifically prophesied by Jesus Christ. In one of the specific signs he gave of his second coming, Christ said that the people of Jerusalem will fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. He prophesied that we're about to enter a time when America's and Britain's global influence will be snuffed out, and Gentile powers, that is, non-Israelite nations, specified in other prophecies, including China and Russia, will wreak unimaginable havoc on the earth. Jerusalem, the literal city located in modern-day Judah will be trodden down of the Gentiles. Revelation 11, verse 2 shows how the Gentiles shall tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months, or 3.5 years. But Bible prophecy also uses Jerusalem, the capital of ancient Israel, to symbolize all of modern Israel, chiefly the Americans and the British. This seismic shift in geopolitical momentum away from America and toward a bunch of non-Israelite Gentile powers, accompanied by an escalation in brutal violence and war, it was specifically prophesied. And it is going to be far worse than people can imagine. But ultimately, it is actually good news. It is one of the signs Jesus Christ gave of his imminent return. The darkness and the evil that are about to flood this globe presage the most wonderful news in human history.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
An organization that worked to document historical crimes and mass human rights violations committed in the Soviet Union was just shut down by Russia's Supreme Court. We'll hear from an official in that organization in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
The Leninist system, regardless of the wishes of its functionaries, was built on lies, secrecy, control of information, and management of public and private consciousness. As soon as the public began to learn the truth about the regime and its countless myths, the foundations of the system began to crack. Truth was a weapon against which the Leninist system was now powerless to fight. These are the words of Dmitry Volkogonov, who was defense advisor to former Russian President Boris Yeltsin. He wrote these words in his book, The Rise and Fall of the Soviet Empire, referring to glasnost. Glasnost, meaning openness in Russian, refers to Soviet policies from the late 1980s where greater freedoms of speech, criticism of the government, and government transparency were allowed, as spearheaded by Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev. It gave Russians a taste of the freedoms of speech and expression that the Western world had enjoyed for decades. As of last month, the Russian government took a massive step in undoing glasnost. Two decisions by the Russian courts threatened to give the truth a weapon that can attack it. One of the organizations that was developed in the wake of glasnost was Memorial, Russia's oldest human rights organization. It was founded in 1989 by grassroots activists wishing to learn the truth about the Gulag system, the system of forced labor camps the Soviet government, especially under Joseph Stalin, used to punish political prisoners. Memorial is decentralized, with many different branches based in cities in Russia and Europe. The two biggest branches are Memorial International, which is the parent branch based in Moscow, and Memorial Human Rights Center, also based in Moscow. Memorial International's focus is on documenting the history of the gulags, while the Human Rights Center focuses on rights abuses in present-day Russia, like advocating support for political prisoners. As of last month, both organizations were ordered to be liquidated. The Human Rights Center by the Moscow City Court, Memorial International by Russia's Supreme Court. The charges for liquidation were brought under Russia's controversial foreign agent law. First passed in 2012, it has caused many problems for non-governmental organizations like Memorial, especially regarding foreign funding. Irina Galkova is the director for Memorial's museum in Moscow. Here is her explanation of the foreign agent law.
You cannot get money from abroad, and when you are doing something that can be named political activity. But there is no explanation what can be taken as political activity and what is not under this term. And in fact, we see that any public opinion, and especially any critic of government decisions made publicly, is taken here in Russia as political activity. But of course, we understood in that period already that we are the best candidate to be proclaimed as foreign agent.
Any organization branded a foreign agent has to make financial and other records constantly available for government inspection and is blacklisted from cooperating with certain state organizations like universities and museums. This forced many smaller NGOs to fold under pressure. But until this point, Memorial was able to keep going. The latest court decisions, which brand Memorial in violation of the foreign agent law, are a major threat. The charges that Memorial is specifically brought under are interesting. A Human Rights Council posed a question to Russian President Vladimir Putin in a meeting regarding Memorial. Galkova explains.
Situation with its liquidation was raised. And Putin told namely that he respects a lot Memorial as an organization, but can't help it because Memorial is justifying the Nazi criminals, as he heard from somebody. We got this line in the court decision.
This charge is severely misleading. Some of the people Memorial lists as political prisoners from the Stalinist period did later become Nazi collaborators during World War II. In the same list as those Nazi collaborators, Memorial also contains people that were later war heroes in the Red Army during World War II. And Memorial has also held exhibitions on the suffering of Russian prisoners sent to Nazi forced labor camps. It is ludicrous to suggest that Memorial is a promotional organization for fascism. Yet this narrative is touted by the highest in Russian society, including President Putin. Russia has come a long way from the Soviet period. The details of the Stalinist repressions and what occurred in the gulags are now fairly well known. Books like Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago are now legal in Russia to own and to read. I asked Ms. Galkova why the Russian government is trying to go after an organization whose focus is documenting those crimes from decades back. She said that the Russian government is trying to avoid associations between itself and the Soviet past. She said this was evident in the prosecutor speeches of the trials of both Memorial International and Memorial Human Rights Center. Keep in mind that these are two different trials for two different organizations.
They have very much of common, but if in case of Memorial International, they were speaking about the bad of our past. In the session on Human Rights Center, they were speaking about the bad picture of current Russia. They don't want the current problems to be evident and visible, and they don't want them to compare to the events placed in Soviet period.
I asked Ms. Galkova if she thought that the recent events mean that the reforms of the late 1980s and 1990s were undone, that glasnost, you could say, is dead. Here is her answer to that.
Yes, and there are such opinions that we went back to, 1980, approximately, if to speak about the freedom of speech, freedom of expression. Of course, we have really very, very great problems with freedom of expression now in Russia, and in late Soviet Union, the situation was better when Memorial emerged. well, it was possible for memorial to emerge in late Soviet times. And now we see that there is no place for us in current situation.
Galkova does feel optimistic that the situation will eventually change in Russia. The rise of the internet and social media means that Moscow has a harder time controlling and containing information than it did during the Soviet period. Nevertheless, for the short term at least, circumstances do look bleak. She told me that, quote, it's evident that it turns always to the worse. We just analyzed the situation from year to year in Russia, and now we have not much hope that, in the next years, there will be some good changes in the situation, end quote. Bringing Russia's levels of freedom of speech back to the pre-Gorbachev era, indeed, makes Russia's near future look dire. In 2005, Vladimir Putin said that the Soviet Union's collapse was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Many analysts interpreted this to mean he mourned how other Soviet republics fell away from Moscow's control. And indeed, one of the most defining legacies of the Putin era has been his attempt to bring those countries back into Russia's orbit. He has sponsored Russian military activities in Ukraine, Georgia, Kazakhstan, and other former Soviet republics. But the latest events with Memorial suggest that he is also trying to rebuild the Soviet Union domestically, within Russia, as in bring back some of the more hardline aspects of Soviet life back into Russian society. Another recent incident with Memorial testifies to this. Yuri Dmitriev is a researcher with Memorial's St. Petersburg branch. He was made famous for discovering the site of a major Stalinist killing field near Russia's border with Finland. He turned it into a site of remembrance that has attracted many foreign visitors year by year interested in learning more about the crimes of the Stalinist period. He was accused of serious charges and threatened with years of imprisonment. Two times the courts acquitted him. Recently, he was sent to court for the same charges a third time and convicted. He now faces 15 years in prison. In his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury made some statements like the following. Putin has a long pattern of diabolical evil on the level of Joseph Stalin, and no leader in Russia has equaled Putin's diabolical evil since Joseph Stalin. This may sound extreme. Stalin was one of the bloodiest mass murderers in history, rivaled by few. Nobody is currently accusing Putin of having killed nearly as many people as Stalin did. But since World War II, Russian leaders have in general been moving away from Stalin's standard. Nikita Khrushchev famously denounced Stalin's legacy and sought to move the Soviet Union away from that. Relations with the United States warmed under Khrushchev's successor, Leonid Brezhnev. Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin tried to introduce Western levels of freedom and prosperity into Russia. By contrast, Vladimir Putin is leading a rehabilitation of Stalin's legacy. By throwing historians researching the Stalinist period into prison, by liquidating historical organizations looking into that history, you could say that Putin's government is becoming Stalin's number one defender. At the very least, Putin's rule has meant a change of direction for Russia. Commenting on Putin's 2005 statement, Mr. Fleury writes, "Given the dozens of millions of Soviet citizens who were imprisoned, persecuted, and murdered under that authoritarian system, most of us would say the opposite. Putin not only mourns the USSR's collapse, he is bent on rebuilding it and restoring the glory of Imperial Russia." Mr. Fleury continues, "If you look at Russia's recent history, you can predict much of its near future." With the memorial liquidations and the other actions he's taken, Putin's government is taking Russia down the path of its recent history under men like Stalin. This does not bode well for Russia's or the world's future. To learn more, please request a free copy of The Prophesied Prince of Russia. You can order a copy at thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Marijuana is being legalized in more and more places in America. In California, the domestic marijuana market is being taken over by Mexican drug cartels, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
People are going missing across Northern California as dangerous drug cartels move into the area. Local sheriffs say they don't even have enough deputies to investigate all the missing people's claims, but believe most of them are linked to the marijuana industry. Detectives recently found the headless bodies of a 17-year-old boy and his father under a pile of burnt tires in Mendocino County. A marijuana farmer murdered both victims after a drug trafficking dispute, and the local sheriff told the Courier-Journal, "It's a punishment to the person who stepped out of line and a message to the next person, don't step out of line." Now, in 2016, California legalized marijuana after years of listening to politicians telling them that marijuana should be regulated, taxed, and taking out of the hands of Latin American criminal syndicates. Yet California's cartel problems have only gotten worse in the 5 years since then. Instead of giving up on drug trafficking, many cartels decided to cash in on America's green gold rush by undercutting the price of legal products offered by farmers who followed the rules and paid their taxes. These cartels are now abandoning decades-old marijuana farms in Mexico so that they can move into Northern California. Mike Senna, who is the executive director of Northern California's high-intensity drug trafficking area task forces, summarized this situation to the Courier-Journal this way. "Why try to bring that bulk marijuana into the United States when you can just grow it in the United States in remote areas like Northern California and then move it across the entire country?" So now the big international players like the Sinaloa cartel are ditching marijuana and heroin production to focus more on the traffic of synthetic chemicals from China. They're trafficking fentanyl, a synthetic opioid that is 50 times more potent than heroin, directly to American consumers. And they're trafficking toxic fertilizers, toxic pesticides, and other chemicals to black market marijuana farms in the United States. The end result is that marijuana is far more accessible and affordable than it was 5 years ago, and the Latin American cartels are still making record profits. Many of the new California marijuana farms are just as bad as the old Mexican ones. Senna continued in his interview that it's like the Wild West. "We've got people in gunfights on a regular basis over marijuana, and the number of missing people is insane. During the growing season, people call their sheriff's office looking for loved ones who may never be found. Some of the marijuana being trafficked across the country is born on the backs of slave labor. Often the people brought in to do the labor are mistreated." Now, many drug cartels are actually selling human beings to California's marijuana growers in addition to the fertilizers, pesticides, and other chemicals. In one recent case, a local sheriff rescued a 16-year-old Mexican girl who didn't know where she was or even how to speak English. Law enforcement believe she was brought into California to have sex with workers on a black market marijuana farm near Covelo, but was discovered by police deputies before she reached her destination. Many who buy marijuana do not realize the money they are spending could be financially supporting sex trafficking, but California policymakers do recognize this fact. Yet many of them still support drug legalization and illegal immigration. California Senator Scott Wiener told the marijuana movement that he actually wants to legalize psychedelic drugs now, and California Governor Gavin Newsom has promised sanctuary to all who seek it. So the Emerald Triangle may soon be just as violent as the worst drug-producing regions in Sinaloa. One councilman from the Round Valley Indian tribe said, "This ain't Mexico City, but it's happening here. It's happening, and our elders are alarmed, 80-year-olds and up, who do not feel safe anymore." Now, this whole situation is a textbook example of the natural consequences of breaking God's law. Many people view drug addiction as a moral crisis, but it is also an undeniable national security crisis. If the American people had not abandoned biblical family values, an entire generation would not have been driven into hopelessness and hedonism. They would not have turned to drugs as a form of escapism. And the alliance we see today between Chinese chemists, Mexican crime syndicates, and American marijuana growers would have never formed. But the American people have abandoned these values. So now the worst drug cartels in Mexico are moving north into California and other states. As Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote in his book, No Freedom Without Law, strong marriages build strong children. We need strong children who are not vulnerable to drugs. Why do children want to take drugs and destroy their minds? The mind is the only thing that even sets them apart from the animals. What is lacking in their lives that would make them want to do that to themselves? Why even take a chance on something so destructive? Drug addiction destroys the will. Now, America could mitigate some of the threats it's facing in California and other states by increasing border security and cracking down on domestic law enforcement. But ultimately, drug addiction and its resulting crime wave are not problems that the White House can permanently solve. They're problems that must be solved in the 128 million individual households across the United States of America.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. This is the type of story that doesn't get a lot of coverage among all of the people who are really enthusiastic about legalizing marijuana. It seems like there is a big push for this in the United States today. There's a whole lot to show that the fruits of doing that are not good. And you have people who would say that if we just legalize it, then it'll eliminate this kind of black market dealing and the kinds of seedy underside of the drug trade that you see going on today. This shows not so much.
Yeah, you would expect something like this to get a little more coverage. I think a lot of the statistics and quotes I brought to you today came from the Courier Journal, from a journalist who did a lot of like in-person investigative work, actually talking to local sheriffs and local councilmen to get these statistics. But you're absolutely right that it does fly directly in the face of what the Californian people were told, that you're like, okay, well, we have a lot of murder and a lot of crime that comes from these drug cartels smuggling drugs into the country. But if we just legalize the drugs and then let the nice man down the street who pays his taxes and follows the law sell them to you instead, then there's no crime if it's legal. And then they did that. And what you're seeing is that, like, okay, well, you're going to get the exact same people who were trafficking drugs before just moved in and realized, like, hey, this is a big opportunity for us, because before we had to spend a lot of money on shipping to get marijuana from Sinaloa to Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. But if we can just grow it in Humboldt County, you still have the same type of beheadings and murders and missing people and sex trafficking and gunfights and chemical spills that you've got in Sinaloa. It's just now happening in the United States. You've moved the production center, but you still get the exact same type of crime with an industry like that, because it's not an industry that brings out the best in people.
Yeah. Well, looked at from a prophetic standpoint, or if you try to examine this, say, from God's view, how do you see what's happening here?
Right. I mean, looking from a prophetic standpoint, you can definitely, there's all sorts of Old Testament prophecies. The ones in Ezekiel pop to mind probably right off the top of my head, especially like Ezekiel 5 that talk about just this. Ezekiel 5 talks about like a third of the nation dying in pestilence, which is just a word that doesn't necessarily mean disease, but just like death and anarchy. And then you've got other ones like in Ezekiel 7 that talks about like make a chain for like blood touches blood, or the land's filled with bloody crimes. And so you've got plenty of prophecies about crime and murder and violence in the United States, the type of prophecies that make you think of the newsreels you see coming out of Mexico. Mm-hmm. But now between the illegal immigration crisis, letting all these Mexicans come in uninhibited, and the drug legalization crisis that actually lets them like apply the drugs that used to be produced in Mexico and sold here can now actually some of them be produced here. You do definitely see a lot of the violence that's taking place in Tijuana and Sinaloa and Mexico City and Acapulco and these other places moving into American cities, bringing just kind of like these grisly but vivid images to mind when you read through those chapters in Ezekiel 5, 6, and 7.
And shamefully, it is our own policies that are encouraging this kind of behavior and proving to be such a curse on America. We thank you for bringing that to us. We've been talking with Andrew Miller about drug cartels taking over the legalized marijuana trade in California. He's working on an article that should appear soon on this subject at thetrumpet.com. Watch for that. Thanks for coming on, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
How can you deepen your friendships? We spoke last week about acceptance, loving your friends for who they are, and encouragement, giving them support when they succeed, encouraging them in their efforts to grow and become better. Here are four more qualities you can cultivate to improve your friendships. First is disclosure. True friends share of themselves. They can have a good laugh or cry in each other's company. They can honestly exchange ideas, opinions, and feelings. They can even disagree without hurting each other. Do you feel like you have to appear perfect around other people? Friends shouldn't be afraid to appear weak, even to ask for help when necessary. It's not that we want to go around telling people about our deepest sins, but neither should we remain so bottled up that we have to suffer our battles entirely alone. People need to be needed. It can make someone feel special when you open up to them. Disclosure probably requires that you test the waters first to see how the other person will respond. You may find someone more sympathetic to your troubles than you would have thought. Sometimes it's amazing how quickly you can bond with someone when you're really sharing yourselves with each other and drawing strength from someone to deal with some difficulty you're experiencing. Jesus Christ said in John 15:15, "Henceforth I call you not servants, for the servant knows not what his Lord does, but I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard of my Father I've made known unto you." Christ knew the value of disclosure to true friendship. A second quality to cultivate is loyalty. Do you always try to put your friends in the best light around others, or do you gossip about them? Friends should never talk behind each other's backs or spread unfavorable information. Proverbs 17 verse 9 says, "He that covers a transgression seeks love, but he that repeats a matter separates very friends." For the relationship to grow, you have to be able to trust each other. We are to show our friends the courtesy that we would want them to extend to us. As Proverbs 18:24 says, "A man that has friends must show himself friendly, and there is a friend that sticks closer than a brother." To have good friends, you must be a good friend. all that you want from your friends, you must give as a friend. Seneca said, if you wish to be loved, love. It's a matter of applying that golden rule, giving to your friends the kind of loyalty and support you would like to receive from them. Nothing deepens a friendship faster. A third quality to cultivate is honesty. We can all get off track and at times do things that are wrong, self-destructive, hurtful to others. Happy is the man who has a true friend who is willing to deliver a faithful wound to set him straight. Proverbs 27 verse 6 says, faithful are the wounds of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy. It's hard to exhort someone, but a true friend is up to the task, and a true friendship will grow stronger as a result. Edward Bulwer Lytton said, one of the surest evidences of friendship that one individual can display to another is telling him gently of a fault. If any other can excel it, it is listening to such a disclosure with gratitude and amending the error. Correcting someone in love requires meekness, tact, and wisdom. If you love someone enough, you'll diligently seek God's help to discern when it needs to be done and how to do it correctly. But what positive fruit that kind of love produces. If, for example, you fulfill the process described in Matthew 18, verses 15 to 17 successfully, as it says in that passage, you have gained your brother. You really do grow closer to another person as a result of that. How true is the wisdom contained in Proverbs 27, verse 17? Iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. A fourth quality to develop is dependability. Being dependable, that means helping when the need arises. Companionship is great during good times, but it is essential during tough times. As Ecclesiastes 4 says, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falls, for he has not another to help him up. It's when we fall that we really need that person beside us to help us up. How dependable are you when someone beside you falls? That's when the quality of your friendship is really tested. Call, send a card, check up, make sure they know they're loved. If you can provide more help, do so. Visit, bring a meal or some groceries, spend time with them. Genesis 14 tells the story of Lot being taken captive by some Gentile kings. When Abram, his uncle, heard of this, he quickly put together a little army of 318 people from his household and went after the captors. He chased them down and retrieved the family, along with all the possessions that had been stolen. What an amazing example of tremendous loyalty and a willingness to personally sacrifice for the sake of a friend. You may not have thought of this, but the friends in your life are the means God has given you to practice the way of give, to practice love. In many ways, cultivating those friendships is among the most important thing we can do in life as we strive to develop godly character. Feed your friendships. Maximize those opportunities to let the roots of those friendships grow into something that will endure for years to come. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Mihailo Zekic and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Colin Powell. Great leaders are almost always great simplifiers.
who can cut through argument, debate, and doubt to offer a solution everybody can understand. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.